It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Vickers.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we'll hear your thoughts on a continuing trend in Wisconsin. People are leaving rural areas, leaving the state, or headed over to bigger metropolitan areas.
First, a new study measures how much we believe in health-related conspiracy theories and how those beliefs might affect our behavior in the doctor's office.
Thomas Wood joins us now. He's co-author of that study from the University of Chicago Political Science Department. It was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, what kind of medical conspiracy theories are we talking about?
We're talking about theories which, on their face, shouldn't elicit much support among those whose primary source of medical information is medical professionals. So quite extreme, quite broadly implausible accounts wherein the United States government and the FDA and pharmaceutical companies know about yet suppress safe natural cures for illnesses, and yet for a profit motivation, I agree not to make those drugs available to the public. Or the idea that vaccines are able to cause autism among young people. Stories which are very anomalous and aberrant to the types of things that we know cause health and sickness from the scientific literature.
And one of the things you asked about in the survey you did for this report is how many people know about some of the particular theories. What are some of the best known ones out there that we've heard of?
So the one about the FDA colluding with the pharmaceutical companies, that's one which is very widely known in the American public. The autism question, another one which is very widely known is this idea that fluoridization is used as a type of control of political opposition rather than as a way to reduce the incidence of dental caries. It really struck us because my co-author and I, Professor Eric Oliver, we normally research political conspiracies. And often when we ask people about whether they've heard of some of the more unlikely, implausible sounding political conspiracies, we get much lower incidences of people having previously heard of those, and we were struck by how widely known some of these accounts are.
Well, why would that be? I guess maybe the political conspiracy, it might upset us, but it might not spread because it doesn't have that personal impact, whereas a health thing, well, gosh, if that's true, that could be a big problem. Is that why it might spread more, do you think?
So that part of it, I think. In politics, we have sometimes the things that we observe going on in the press and is reported on. Like, we can make sense of politics using the historical record, and sometimes politics makes sense that way. But when we're dealing with something as uncertain, as often invisible as the things which make us healthy and sick, I think people are drawn to accounts which give that order. Like, people generally, this is apparent in the psychological literature, when they're aware of some things being from uncertain or seemingly random sources, like why some people get sick, why others don't get sick, why some people respond to pharmaceuticals, others don't. We don't like those sort of uncertain, deeply, at their heart, random accounts. And so we've traditionally sought to give order to that, even if it's an illogical, uncertain type of story. And that's sometimes why we see the proliferation of conspiracy theories accounting for medical phenomena.
So you're saying we want medical science to give us a clear-cut answer. Blank causes blank. If you don't blank, you won't get the disease. The reality is we're talking statistics a lot of the time, so people look for something more straightforward, even if it doesn't seem plausible.
We're not drawn to these deeply contingent and conditional answers, and the fact that medical science often has to tell us this is our best guess, a new study or new data might suggest some other relationship. People are unsatisfied with that. And whereas physicians and epidemiologists only make those claims because that's all that the data allow them to make, often people read malicious intent, malign intent in making those sorts of arguments. And so it's a simpler world in which people actively, the physicians are actively conspiring against this rather than they're often sometimes simply powerless against certain maledictions. And so that's not an attractive worldview that people adopt.
there are people listening right now, I'm sure, who are thinking, wait, conspiracy theory? Whether we're talking about fluoridation of water or the vaccine autism concept, they're thinking that's not a conspiracy theory. I think that's true, or I think the jury's out on it. Have you gotten some angry responses since this paper came out?
Really? So that's really all we've received from the audience. It struck my co-author and I, when we've spoken about political conspiracies, it hasn't elicited nearly so much response on the basis of the face validity of the claims. And so, I mean, like, I guess the best answer we have is that we're not medical professionals. We're making no claim about the inherent truth or inaccuracy of these accounts. We are really only interested in those things which predict the rise and decline of these particular theories and the consequence that these theories adoption have on the type of health behaviors people engage in. So if it's your conviction that all these accounts are true, like none of our research can speak to the validity or falseness of those claims. Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to take it to the next point you just mentioned there, the consequences of people having these beliefs and how it might affect their health behaviors. What in your survey and your research have you found?
So it's hard to tease apart cause and effect. It's the sort of thing where we wouldn't be able to do an experiment under medical ethics rules. We couldn't randomly induce in some people some set of beliefs about medical conspiracies and then observe the consequential behavior. So instead, we're left with statistics to use controls to try to determine the effect of just these attitudes on medical behaviors, holding all of our things constant. And when we do those sorts of studies, a very interesting pattern emerges wherein the types of people who adopt and evince support for these conspiracies are much less likely to engage in the preventative medical practices that we know are very important to maintaining health. So they're less likely to see a doctor for a checkup. They're less likely to visit a dentist. They're less likely to wear sunscreen. They're more likely to think that herbal remedies are a good source of a good way to treat illness. And these results are apparent even after we've removed the separate effects of people's education, their race, their income, and those sorts of things. And so it does appear as if these behaviors do have meaningful, tangible consequences on health outcomes.
Do you think there are any lessons here about how to communicate with the public about health issues, either broad stroke public health or a doctor in their office?
I think the relationship with, like, the consequence of this study is this private relationship between a doctor and her patient is very meaningful, because almost the worst thing to do would be to engage some massive government or pharmaceutical apparatus to attempt to dispel these ideas, because
they're in only
among that coterie of people for whom these attitudes are fundamental to their worldview. Like, such a program would appear like consistent with his claims, but for those like fortunate occasions where folks who adopt these attitudes are suspicious of physicians, when they are, with a physician, I think this is a useful tool for a diagnostic capacity of, is this patient likely to participate and abide by the prescribed pharmaceuticals, whatever that the prescribed course of treatment that I'm suggesting. I think this, like, if it's apparent that a patient has some of these worldviews, some of these attitudes, I think it's a fairly good indication that the doctor should pay a special attention to the patient's subsequent behavior, or behavior outside the surgery, because, like, it's very likely that these are the people for whom their suspicion will reduce the extent to which they abide by the undertakings they make to the physician.
Tom, before I let you go, I want to ask why you and your colleague are interested in conspiracy theories in general, political, medical, or otherwise.
It's part of a broader project. There's been evidence for the last 20 to 30 years coming out of universities like Wisconsin and Michigan and Chicago that the ways in which people make political decisions doesn't really reflect a dispassionate weighing of their material circumstance. People use these sort of narratives as a way to sort of make homespun conceptions of politics and the world and then deduce political and other attitudes from these narratives. And so this is part of a broader project that Professor Oliver and I are pursuing to sort of come to grips with the ways that people make political decisions and people make political determinations, and interestingly enough, it also impacts really meaningful things. So you might think that, like, if a person adopts a political attitude, a political conspiracy, and that has consequences, that political attitudes, like, who cares really, you know? But when it's even impacting things like how frequently these people visit the dentist or whether they're willing to wear sunscreen, it seems that there's something much more fundamental at work here, and it's just interesting to understand that way of decision making.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Thomas Wood, co-author of a new study on medical conspiracy theories.
A lot of people listen to music at work, but not all music is created equal, especially if you have a lot of word-related work to do. Later in the show, we'll find out the best kinds of music to listen to while you're doing different kinds of work.
First, rural Wisconsin communities are declining in population. It's a trend that's been going on for the past decade at least, and new census data for 2013 out reaffirms it, with 40 counties having declined at least a little bit in population since 2010.
On the flip side, metropolitan areas in Wisconsin seem to be growing. While Milwaukee isn't growing as quickly as other cities around the country, it is still increasing in population, and Dane County saw 4.3% growth in 3 years.
We want to hear from you about the trends you see in your area. Are young people leaving your rural community? Are you worried about the population going down where you live? Are you seeing retirees going to warmer weather or going to a metropolitan area or to a more rural area? Are you one of these people moving from place to place? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're joined now by Rochelle Winkler, Assistant Professor of Demography and Sociology at Michigan Tech. She's a former associate scientist at the Applied Population Lab at UW-Madison. Rochelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, can you fill us in? What are the findings about rural counties in particular, according to this new information?
Well, I would first start by saying that I'm not sure that really the decline that we've seen has been over the last decade. It's more since the second half of the decade with the beginning of the economic recession. So really what we're seeing here needs to be placed within a broader context that's affecting the whole United States. We're really seeing a slowdown of migration as a whole, especially retirement migration, but the migration rates are the lowest that we've seen in the last few years since World War II. So it's more a slowdown of migration than anything else. We're also seeing a slowdown in births. We have record low birth rates in 2012. And both of these things are associated with the economic recession. We're also seeing a slowdown in international net migration and aging population as a whole. And these things particularly affect more rural areas of the country in Wisconsin and elsewhere because more rural areas are places where we've long seen a net out-migration of young adults, but they have been holding their own in many decades and even growing because of net migration in among older people, retirement ages, but also families with children. And so the slowdowns of those migration among families with children and retirees are what's causing the population loss in more rural areas, especially given that they tend to have older populations. And so many of them are in Wisconsin and elsewhere are experiencing what we might think of as natural decrease, more deaths than births. And this is something that's been going on for quite some time and is becoming more common as the population ages.
And
in
so
the past, that's been kind of made up for by this net migration. But now that the migration's slowing down, it's not making up for the deaths.
Okay, so you're saying that the headline isn't really rural counties suffering population decline. You're saying we're looking at a bigger trend, and it has more to do with these factors going on since the recession.
Yes.
And what about the metropolitan areas? We've talked about how the rural counties, a slight dip, but you're saying that it's maybe par for the course. How are metro areas doing?
Well, metropolitan areas have benefited from this in the sense that the rural areas were attracting more retirees and families with children who have moved out of the city centers and suburban areas toward more rural areas. And so when migration as a whole slows down considerably, then those folks stay in the metro areas and don't move into the rural areas. So the more metro areas have benefited from that process. more so than the more rural areas. They also have younger populations, and so they have continued to experience more births than deaths. So growing through the process of more babies being born than people dying as well. And then young adults are continuing to move out of more rural areas as they have been for decades. They have slowed down in their rate, but they're still doing it. And they tend to move to more metropolitan areas. So the metro areas have been growing more quickly than the more rural areas since the recession began, really. And, we think of the recession as maybe being over, or at least things are getting better. But demographically, in terms of the demographic factors like migration and birth rates, we have not seen those start to recover yet.
I would imagine that rural counties, rural towns, too, would be more vulnerable to dips in population, even if the rest of the country is experiencing these same sort of ebbs, because rural communities are a little more balanced on the edge of the knife, aren't they?
Well, I'm not sure if you could exactly say that. I mean, a lot of our rural areas have seen continued net out-migration of young adults for decades and decades. And so that continual pattern does create a lot of difficulties, particularly with regard to an aging population and just a culture of out-migration, this idea that young people need to go away when they graduate from high school because there aren't opportunities for them there. And so really I think the challenge for more rural areas is kind of reframing themselves and creating some new identities that are associated with being good places for people to live. And a lot of the more rural areas in Wisconsin have really done that with regards to being good places to live for older people, for retirees, having a lot of natural resources and amenities, and also for families with children, but not so much for young people. And that's one of the places where, getting creative about what kind of community, about placemaking, I guess, is one of the terms that gets thrown around, might help.
There seems to be a perception in Wisconsin that recent graduates might leave Wisconsin to find better job opportunities. And the population of the state, though, on the whole, it's increased slightly. Is there a brain drain going on in Wisconsin, or is that a misconception?
I would lean to say that that's a misconception. The state of Wisconsin does pretty well with holding its own population and its college-educated population. It's true that people from out of state tend to attend some of the universities in Wisconsin. We have some really good schools, and so you do see some people who go to college within the state of Wisconsin and then go back to their home state or go elsewhere for some time after college. But as a whole, Wisconsin is not one of the states that's really suffering from brain drain.
And when young people leave Wisconsin, do we know where they go, and does it matter?
We know some of the places that they go. They also oftentimes come back. So it's a little bit tricky. I mean, certainly the data indicate that a chunk of young people who move out of the state of Wisconsin tend to move to some of the cities in the Midwest, like Chicago or Minneapolis, St. Paul. I don't know how much we can really say how much that matters or not. It's difficult to then say exactly who goes and who comes back. There aren't good data really tracking people because we don't have a registration system within this country. So we have a general sense of where people go and where people move to and from, but we can't really track in a longitudinal way individuals and their patterns over their life course.
Now, we're just about out of time, but can we expect any of the changes we've been talking about to be different anytime soon?
I think that there are some opportunities for things to change, particularly at some point. we should start to see some of the demographic impacts of the recession to level off. Birth rates will at some point rebound. It would be very surprising if they didn't. And also migration rates will likely rebound. And then we might see some changes here. And also there are certainly opportunities for community change. And there are some examples of places that have kind of turned things around in terms of reducing young adult net migration or increasing migration of families with children.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Rochelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Rochelle Winkler, Assistant Professor of Demography and Sociology at Michigan Tech. She's a former associate scientist at the Applied Population Lab at UW-Madison.
We've been talking big picture about migration. You can help us put a name and a place to it. Tell us about your decision of where to live, where to move. What is your town doing, maybe your rural community doing, to keep people there, to bring people in? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We just spoke with demographer Rochelle Winkler about those trends, and now we'd like to hear from you.
Call in at 800-642-1234. Are you in a small town or a rural community? Do you see people headed out, or has your community made a conscious effort to reinvent itself, make itself an attractive place to live for young people, for retirees to move to after their careers? Call in at 800-642-1234. And what is the charm of living in a small town? Again, 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can post on our Central Time Facebook page.
And we did have this comment from Hans in New Berlin, who called to say, I grew up in a rural community and moved to an urban community to find work and to make a living. I'd love to move back to a more rural area, but it was too difficult to find jobs. Does that sound familiar to you? Was it a necessity that made you move somewhere else, made you leave your small town? Was it just work? And would you like to get back there? And if you want to lure people back to small towns, what needs to happen? What needs to change to make small towns more of a destination, a place where people want to raise families and work and live out their lives? Our number, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And it's interesting, out in the community, we've heard from people around the state worried from smaller towns up to places as big as Wausau that they're having trouble keeping younger people there. They're worried about the future of the community. Is this a concern in your part of the state? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. 800-642-1234. Maybe we're not touching a nerve. I don't know. How about your personal decision? Did you move out of a small town into a bigger city, out of the state? Do you want to go back? Or are you glad you made the move? 800-642-1234. We've got Lisa on the line now in Milwaukee. Lisa, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I hate living in southeast Wisconsin, and I would live somewhere else if I could, but there are more jobs here. Also, you know, there are more medical services and mental health services, which I have family members who need those services. So that's kind of what forced me out of a small city.
Where did you move from before you went to Milwaukee, Lisa?
I don't live in the city of Milwaukee. That I can't quite stomach. I live in the outskirts of Milwaukee, which is a little better, but I came from the Manitowoc area.
That's right.
And there is a very little work opportunity and just very little options for anything else, for any other kind of services, you know, unless you're an alcoholic.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lisa. Appreciate hearing your story. And we'll move on next to Casey in Black River Falls. Hi, Casey.
Hey, how are you doing?
Okay. What do you think about where you live?
The town I live in, Black River Falls, used to have a sense of community. There used to be a free pool that was donated downtown where every socioeconomic class got together and they got to know each other. So everybody knew each other. And somebody took it because they wanted that piece of property, and they found some flaws in the gift. And then on top of that, too, the problem is that once you make a mistake, you have to leave because, your job opportunities, which are very little to begin with, disappear.
Okay, so you're saying that it is kind of a tough thing to stay in a small town, but if you can make it work, you've enjoyed it.
No. I'm trying to get the heck out.
Oh, you're trying to get out. Okay, I thought you were saying there was a sense of community, and you're saying the community is gone.
No, it lost its sense of community, that it once had.
Gotcha. All right. Well, thank you so much, Casey. Appreciate hearing your story.
Now I'll go to Caleb with us in Richland Center. Caleb, hi.
Hi. I would just like to say that coming from a small area like Richland Center and growing up here, the biggest thing for us is, like, as kids, is there's not a much, like, not enough for us to do as far as activities, or, I mean, we have, like, a bowling alley and things like that, so that's kind of, like, one of the bigger issues. The jobs is an issue, too. There's a lot of people that come here for, like, a retirement town, and it's harder for us to, as young kids, you know, to find jobs after school and things of that nature, so that kind of drives people out, too, so...
And Caleb, looking to the future, do you see yourself in Richland Center 5-10 years from now?
I do, because of the field that I've gone into, but like my family or my brothers, you know, they moved to like La Crosse and Madison, you know, because that's where their job opportunity is. Fortunate enough for me, I like it here. I would love to grow and have a family here. People are nice. People, you know, you're not scared to leave your door unlocked, or, you know, and your neighbors become friends and things of that nature. That's nice about it, too.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for calling and telling us what you think, Caleb. And we'll move on to Jay in Prairie Farm. Hey, Jay.
Hello. Hello. I'm probably going to throw off your discussion a little bit. My partner and I moved from northeast Minneapolis to Prairie Farm, Wisconsin. And he's a vice president of a supplement company and is lucky enough to work out of the house. And I'm a published author, and we produce the nation's first pumpkin seed oil. We're a certified organic part-time farmers.
So you found yourself with the freedom to move around, and you chose Prairie Farm.
It's beautiful here. It's in the middle of nowhere, basically, rolling hills and so forth.
Yeah, where is it? I haven't heard of Prairie Farm.
We're north of Menominee, about 40 miles.
Okay, and so are you happy with that decision so far?
We love it here. Definitely love it here. It's just very special. And one of the many treasures is our neighbors, and there's a great deal of CSAs here. So a lot of people, since we're only 90 miles from Minneapolis, a lot of CSAs deliver into the city. So that works out really well as well.
Jay,
and I think you can just create with it whatever environment you want, wherever you are. I mean, it's amazing how you can recreate yourself.
All right, Jay, thank you so much for sharing your story. We're talking about people moving around in Wisconsin. Some census data showing mostly a decline in our rural counties, growth in some of the urban ones. Is there concern in your community about people moving out, not moving back in, losing the character of the town? Or maybe you're trying to rebuild, rebrand the character of your town. Call 800-642-1234. Ken is with us in Reedsburg. And Ken, when I hear the idea of rebranding a smaller Wisconsin town, Reedsburg popped into my head. What do you think about your town there?
Yeah, well, you know, we are actually one of the fastest growing small communities in the state. We grew by 52% between the 1990 and the 2010 census, but last year there was one new house built in the community. So we really saw right when the recession hit that the number of people coming into the community stopped.
Do you think that's going to pick up again? And what has Reedsburg been doing to encourage people to move in and had that big growth in the earlier years?
Yeah, well, you know, we've identified it as a problem, as an issue, and so we've been working for the past year on rebranding the community and trying to figure out what we can do to get that growth started again for the community. You know, one of the interesting things that we discovered in that branding process was that we're actually a net importer of jobs. We actually have a higher daytime population by about 2,000 people coming into the community to work. So it's not necessarily a jobs issue for us. I think a lot of it just has to do with the cost of housing and the property values dropping, so you don't see the people moving up into a new or bigger house that we saw before the recession.
Interesting. Ken, thanks for calling. Thanks for sharing Reedsburg's story with us.
And we'll go next to Beth in Burlington. Hi, Beth.
Hiya. I actually work for a dentist in Burlington. I went to high school next door in Waterford, another very small community. And we've actually noticed a lot of the mid-20s age people starting to move back to town after, you know, moving out after high school, saying, oh, I hate the small towns. But now as they're getting married and starting families, they're moving back to these small towns because it is a safer environment. And, you know, there is that small town camaraderie that we do have here.
And is there something Burlington's doing that's helping make that easier for people to move back?
Well, we are starting to get, you know, we've got a Walmart in town here. We've got, you know, a little more of the bigger stores like Taco Bell, stuff like that, that we didn't have in previous years. And so now people are able to stay in town more to find the goods and services that they need. As far as jobs, we've got an industrial park here in town, another one in, nearby in Waterford, you know, for... And we actually have, you know, because they do have a client base to kind of refer to, we have a lot of our patients will actually work in the larger towns and then live in smaller towns. You know, they'll go to work to Hill's Corners.
Got it. Beth, we're going to have to leave it there. But thank you so much for sharing your experience and what's happening in Burlington in your neck of the woods. We've been talking about new 2013 census data out today that shows a continuing trend of Wisconsinites leaving rural areas and growing populations in metro areas. You can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. A lot of people listen to music at work, and with websites like Pandora and Spotify, it's easier now than it used to be to create your own customized playlist. But are you listening to the right kind of music?
Our guest wrote a piece for Quartz called The Complete Guide to Listening to Music at Work. Adam Posick is Senior Asia Correspondent for Quartz at QZ.com. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics. How does music actually affect our brains when we're listening?
Well, when music goes into your brain, it's taking up some of your brain's processing power. So when you're trying to do some work, you know, there's a chance that it could get in the way, but it also affects your brain's mood and your energy levels. So it can help you in a positive way or a negative way or some mix of the two.
Well, how does listening to music make work easier? We'll get back to the distraction point in a few, but how does it help us, or how can it help us?
They've been doing experiments on this for like 50 or 60 years, and it turns out, you know, starting when they had people working on assembly lines, they were trying to figure out how to get the most work out of their employees, and they found that playing kind of upbeat, happy, happy music made people actually work a little bit harder. And so since people have been doing these experiments for a long time and trying to figure it out, they've just figured out that music can affect your brain's arousal levels, which basically means kind of how much energy and focus and alertness you have. So if you're listening to the right kind of music, it can give you a boost that way.
Well, let's check out the upbeat music. Here's a piece we cannot escape these days, Pharrell Williams' Happy. So upbeat music could help us at certain kinds of work. What kinds of work does happy, upbeat music help us with in particular, Adam?
They found that it really helps you when you're doing stuff that doesn't require a lot of kind of deep reasoning or memorization, but maybe when you're doing a slightly tedious task where you have to kind of stay alert, but you don't need to do a whole lot of kind of deep reasoning or think about things too hard. Kind of like when you're driving, your brain has to be alert, but you're not really devoting all of your mental energies to the task. So when you're doing something repetitive or something where it's a little bit hard to keep from getting bored, that's one time when music can help you.
Well, I'm running into one of the challenges right now. I've got music with lyrics behind me, and I'm trying to think in words. When is it important to choose music without lyrics?
When you're doing something like that requires, when you're reading, something that requires reading comprehension, or when you have to kind of absorb a lot of information that you'll need to remember it later, listening to music with words works at cross purposes to that, because anytime you're listening to music with words, even if you're not really trying to, your brain's going to spend a certain amount of its cognitive bandwidth on listening to those words and understanding those words, which then kind of draws down on the amount of mental energy that you can, on the job that you're trying to do. So if you're doing something with words, you should try and find music that doesn't have any, something that's a cappella or jazz or orchestra, classical music, something that isn't going to be, you know, drawing on those parts of your brain that you'll need for the job.
So in a way, I mean, we already multitask ourselves into distraction as it is, and maybe if we're doing word-related work and we add music with lyrics, we're adding an underlying baseline of multitasking that we're not even aware of.
Exactly. And I mean, all the research on multitasking shows that we're not actually that good at it. Multitasking is kind of everyone's day-to-day life, but the research shows that, you know, when you try and multitask, you end up doing a lot of things not quite as well. So when you're trying to get the biggest boost out of music, you want to limit the amount that your brain is being multitasked.
I had that experience. I used to do work with a lot of typing. Well, I still do, and spreadsheets and things like that, and music with lyrics just killed it. I could not do it. I discovered Goa music, which is this like electronic dance music. I gather the intended audience is supposed to be dancing and taking smart drugs. I was sitting at a desk and doing spreadsheets. Not quite the same. But does that sound like the kind of nice thing? Up tempo, but no words.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. Your brain is it spends a lot of time trying to predict what's going to happen next in your immediate surroundings. And so if you have music that's kind of steady and kind of droning music that isn't changing a lot in terms of like the tempo or
that
the
was
mood,
it, yeah.
Yeah, or it has kind of like a propulsive beat, then that's the kind of music where your brain's like, okay, I know exactly what's going to happen next to this music. I don't need to spend a whole lot of energy trying to figure it out. And therefore, you get the same kind of mood-boosting, energy-level-boosting effect, but you're not distracted in the same way that you might be with some other kinds of music.
Well, we've got one of, I gather, your favorite ones, a Sigur Rós song, and I never know if I'm pronouncing that band name right. I know I like them, but let's give a
look. I think that's right, but I'm not really sure either.
All right, so there's lyrics there. What is different about those lyrics that might not distract us as much?
Well, that band tends to sing in a made-up language of their own invention. And so I think one little trick is if you do want to listen to music with word, or listen to music that has lyrics to it, pick a language that you don't understand. Or in the case of Sigur Rós, it's probably impossible to understand.
Right, and I've always found that I enjoy really bad pop music from another country, as long as I don't understand the words. Maybe that's part of why it doesn't distract me. It's not pulling my brain aside all the time.
Exactly.
And so Sigur Rós, with her made-up language, the only people that would distract are Sigur Rós.
Yep. If you're a linguistics major and you're trying to figure out the language they had created, but thankfully that's not a problem for me.
Well, now that song had a strong emotional appeal, and that reminds me of something else you wrote about, avoiding music that has lots of emotional peaks and valleys. Why would that be a problem?
That's kind of back to what I was saying earlier about having a kind of steady state music that doesn't change a lot. When there's a song that has a lot of peaks and valleys, like big emotional climaxes, then I think your brain will spend some of its cognitive resources trying to guess what's going to happen next and trying to anticipate those peaks and valleys. And strangely enough, the research shows that even that little bit of stuff that's going on in the background can really affect your performance when you're on the job.
Now, assuming we find the right music to listen to at whatever kind of work we do, should we have it going the whole time, or is there a diminishing returns after a while?
No, I think the best way to do it is to kind of have it on intermittently. So maybe there's some tasks that you're doing that are maybe the most complicated, demanding thing that you have on your to-do list that day. Maybe try to do it in absolute silence. And then when you have kind of a longer, drawn-out task where it's a little more repetitive, then find some energetic music. One thing that you can do is to use music to set you up for a task. So if you can find a kind of inspirational music that kind of gets your pulse going, listen to the music before you work, and then turn off the music and get to the job. Or if you have a big meeting that you're going to go to, you know, play the music to get yourself kind of pumped up for it. And then you get all the benefits of listening to music in terms of the energy that it gives you and the way that it improves your mood, but you don't get any of the downsides in terms of how it can distract you.
All right, so pre-screening the music. You recommended a piece of inspirational music, going back a little bit, to the Top Gun theme.
Well, movie soundtracks in general are really good because they're kind of designed to get your pulse pounding in that way. Top Gun's, I think, a personal favorite of mine. It's hard not to hear that music and get a little bit charged up, but it really depends on your own personal preference.
Yeah, so I could just jump into my Navy jet fighter right now with this music playing and really feel pumped up for the next mission. Well, I'm just picturing myself before I come on the air now, like listening to, I don't know, the Final Countdown thing. I'd feel a little goofy if my coworkers, if my producer was watching me do that, though. Is it important to do this behind locked doors, this pumped up music?
Well, I think one thing about working in a lot of offices these days is you get used to everybody wearing headphones. So I'm sure most of your coworkers would probably appreciate it. It might save you a little bit of embarrassment, to be sure.
Okay. Well, I don't know. Sometimes I like to annoy my coworkers. You did find, though, that it's also good to use music services like Pandora or Spotify or one of those while you're at work. What's the benefit of those?
Well, I mean, the nice thing about those is they have just about every song you can think of or pretty close. And so, you know, it used to be if you wanted to listen to music at work, you had to bring a CD, you had to bring a Walkman. It was kind of a big deal, and you had to pick your music ahead of time. Now, there's, you know, all these playlists. There's one playlist that that we posted with my article on Quartz.com that you can listen to the songs that we've suggested. But, I mean, really, there's an infinite amount of music that's out there. And if you want to dip into some genre that you think might be good for your work, if you want it, whether that's jazz or classical or minimalist composers or movie soundtracks, it's really easy now to explore using all these music services.
You know, flipping it around completely, I've talked to people who are painters who do manual work, and they've told me they really like, and I'm very happy about this, to listen to talk radio while they're working. It's something that kind of keeps them going through the day. When is talking or maybe even music with lyrics maybe the appropriate thing to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think my article that I wrote was kind of written in mind for the people who are working in an office, maybe working on a computer, that kind of thing. Obviously, there's a million different jobs out there that don't fit that situation. And yeah, I have a lot of friends who are not working with words and computers all day, and they love to listen to talk radio or podcasts or things that have more of a kind of verbal aspect to them. So it really does depend on your job. It might be that you're working at home and you're with your kids and you want to have a dance party, and that's your work music. But it really depends, you know, it's a personal preference. It depends on the kind of job you're trying to get done, and it depends on the kind of music that works best for you.
And Adam, what are you listening to at work lately?
Lately at work, I've been listening to a lot of it's music that I never really had considered before I started trying to find the right work soundtrack, but there are these minimalist composers that got started, I guess, in like the 70s and 80s, people like Philip Glass and Steve Reich.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like you mentioned, that they have these kind of very steady, droning, kind of repetitive music, but it still has this kind of propulsive energy to it. And I find that when I need like a little pick-me-up at work and I need to kind of crank out an article or get a big job done, that if I can kind of get these playing, then it really gives me a boost. And the nice thing is that if you keep using those songs over and over again, your brain gets used to, oh, well, I'm hearing that song again. That means it's time to crank into gear.
Getting a little Pavlovian there. Ring that bell,
yeah,
and we
exactly.
Salivate for work. Well, interesting stuff. Right. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Adam Pasek, Senior Asia Correspondent for Quartz, giving us advice on what kind of music to listen to at work.
Up next, an article in a Wisconsin high school newspaper has sparked controversy and raised questions of press freedom for student publications. We'll hear from the student at the center of the story. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.